Great. Thank you guys all for coming. The session is about leadership within the family. What we're going to do is talk a little bit about catalyzing change within the family, getting the foundation to move, getting the foundation to do something a little different, to work a different way. Really with the idea that at least in our experience at the Philanthropic Initiative, there's so many families that feel a little bit stuck. And it often can take just one individual to really move that foundation forward. So let me kind of introduce who we have here and then kind of run down what we'd like to do today. So starting over on the, here's Eliza Sutherland. She's a philanthropic advisor with TPI, the Philanthropic Initiative, 25-year-old nonprofit with a mission to increase the impact of philanthropy in society. And we do that by advancing the broader field of strategic philanthropy and also by directly advising individuals, families, foundations, and corporations in their giving. Next to Eliza is Fred Daniels, who is the president of the Fred Harris Daniels Foundation. Family Foundation started in 49, now just tapping into the fourth generation. Fred is of the third generation. Okay. So they give, historically they've given primarily in Worcester, Massachusetts. Anybody familiar with Worcester? And have more recently become a strategic initiative around funding middle school aged girls.
Not middle aged girls.
Not yet.
it's a common trip of the tongue. You're right.
Sitting next to Fred is Deborah Rusi, who is one of the three trustees and program officer at the Sills Family Foundation. She sits on the foundation with two of her uncles. It was her grandfather's estate that created the foundation. So they have three different kind of areas where they support. Comprehensive support for families in crisis, with a special focus on incarcerated parents and their children, which I think has grown to be one of your primary focus. And as well as some around early elementary childhood education and environmental justice, focused on contaminants that harm developing embryos, fetus, and infants. Great. So what we'd like to do today is, Liza's gonna start, just talk a little bit about leadership, kind of how we see it, how we define it, how it can play a role in change. Then we are going to hear from Fred and from Deborah, just about their experiences in kind of moving their foundations in different directions, in the directions they'd like to see it. And throughout this, we're going to be asking you all to think about what is the change that you're trying to achieve in your giving, in your family, in your foundation. And we're going to be kind of working along that. So the first half, we'll kind of hear from everyone. And then the second half of this session is really more about taking a closer dive at some of the obstacles that you face in change. What are some of the approaches that you've tried, some of the approaches that have both been successful and unsuccessful? And we're going to just work and have kind of some small group conversations to approach some of those and share our own personal experiences and do a little peer learning from your new friends at your table. So with that, I would love to, first of all, give anybody a chance to say, to run out of the room.
Before we lock the doors.
Yeah. Great. So with that, I want to turn things over to Liza. Sure. And thank you all for spending some time with us today.
So I think when we're talking about these big concepts like leadership and change, it's always easy to start with a common language so we can sort of empower you as leaders at your foundations where you may not be an official leader, you may not have the title of board president, or you may not think of yourself as a leader, but there are ways to think about this, about ways you can be empowered to bring change to your foundation. So if you think about leadership as an activity, as a steward of change, rather than a position of authority or a personal characteristic. It's not, there's the saying, leaders are born, not made, but I actually believe leadership is a practiced skill. It's not about commanding and controlling, it's not top down, but it's about cultivating and coordinating activities to see the change that you want to bring to your foundation. And leadership skills develop over time. The more you practice, the more you follow role models, the more you study leadership, the easier it will be for you, and the more you will be practiced at it. And like we talked about with systems change yesterday at the plenary, leadership and change take time. You'll face obstacles, and I'm sure you've already faced many in your foundations as you're trying to bring about change and you're grappling with some really tough issues, but it takes time, and if you stick with it, you'll see the change that you want to see. So to help you think through how to go about change and how to face some of those obstacles, I just want to outline a framework for change. I'm borrowing this framework from John Cotter, a former professor at the Harvard Business School who is an authority on leadership, an authority on change, and he's studied it in the business context and seen many large-scale changes and seen what's failed and what's worked. And sort of developed that and tweaked it for the foundation context. And it applies to making any sort of change. And he had this 8-stage process. Every change for an organization to change, it has to go through these 8 stages. And I've sort of boiled it down to 4 stages for you, which I, if my microphone will follow me, I will write out here so we can visualize what I'm talking about. So the 4 steps. Strategize, mobilize, implement, and sustain. So within each of those 4 steps, strategize, mobilize, implement, and sustain. There are some other activities that go on to make up those steps. So strategizing. First of all, a place where a lot of large-scale change fails is not creating enough of a sense of urgency. So to make people have a reason to change the status quo. Status quo is easy. It's easy to keep doing what you've been doing, to continue on giving how you've been giving, and not make any change. Everybody's used to it, they're comfortable with it. If they don't feel a sense of urgency about why you need to change, then nobody's ever going to stick with that change. So create a sense of urgency. And usually, when you go to a conference, you get inspired by all these new big ideas, and you want to bring them back to your foundation. This is where creating that urgency and communicating those ideas to your foundation is really an important step. You also want to develop a vision of what's going to be better if you go through this change. I'm still working. I thought I didn't hear myself anymore. So create a vision and a strategy for reaching that vision. Under mobilize, you want to get some people on your team. You can't go it alone. You need some change makers to be on your team, so people who have some influence in your foundation. So create a guiding coalition. You also want to communicate your change vision. You want to make sure everybody knows what this change is. You don't want to just communicate it to the people on your team, but everybody needs to understand what you're trying to do here, what the change needs to be. And the more everybody hears it, the more it becomes part of the story, and then it's easier to move forward in the next steps. So communicate. And then down in implementation, that's where you need to start action. Get rid of some obstacles. For example, I recently worked with a foundation who had a very lean staff, and they prided themselves on being very leanly staffed, but giving away a lot of money. And over the years, the foundation, the trustees, had required X, Y, and Z documents at every board meeting, and over the years it amassed this huge pile of documents that the staff had to provide to the board every board meeting. Well, then the board decided they really wanted the staff to be in the community, working with grantees, very hands-on, but the staff said, well, we have too much paperwork to do. We can't do that. So they eliminated that obstacle. The board changed the reporting requirements. They changed what they wanted to see, which allowed their staff to be in the community. So getting rid of obstacles, starting to make those small steps toward your change. also want to generate some short-term wins. We heard this yesterday in systems change. If you want to people to stick in it for the long haul, they need to have those short-term wins and see some progress along the way. And then finally, I think a place where, well, I don't think it's been documented, a lot of people fail to realize their change is in sustaining. They declare victory too soon. You know, if say for example your change is you want your board to communicate more between meetings, you want to have more interaction, so you set up a Facebook group. You get everybody to join your Facebook group and you say, yay, we did it. We were there. Everybody has joined our Facebook group. We're communicating. We've done it. 2 months later, nobody is using the Facebook group. So you didn't achieve your change. And what has to happen is whatever change you're making, it has to become part of your culture. It has to be, this is the way we do things. We use this Facebook group. We communicate between meetings. This is what we do. And until you get to that point of, this is what we do, this is how we operate, your change may not stick. And so this part, although it seems, you know, you've done all the hard work, you got there, you got the change, you know, you made it, but then it doesn't stick. So make it stick, become part of your culture. So, and it's easy to think of these steps as linear. You do one, then you move to two, then you move to three, and it doesn't really have to work that way. You could be working on still communicating your vision or creating, you know, getting some people on your team while starting to eliminate some obstacles. They can be simultaneous activities. It's fluid. It's not step by step. You can be in three stages at once. So I hope that this is helpful as you think about your foundations and the change you're trying to achieve, and just puts a framework around how you might go through the process of seeing change.
Great, thank you. And speaking of that change, what kind of change are you all hoping to see in your foundation? I'd just love to get a sense of, if anybody's willing to share, what are they trying to change? What are they trying to see? What would they like to see differently within their family foundation?
We're approaching a generational change of ours. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a fairly tightly controlled generation two is a transition to a larger G3, and we haven't had a lot of hands-on experience.
Mm-hmm. Great. That's absolutely a big change.
I'm going to repeat what people say for the recording rather than make you stand up at the microphone. So that was about generational change and a change in bringing more people onto the board.
But by all means, it would make you feel more important to stand up at the microphone.
Get up and go.
What are some other examples of what sort of change you'd like to see in your foundation? What I'd love everyone to do is in your at your table, there's these worksheets. If you just grab those, for the process of today's conversation, pick a specific goal, pick something tangible that you'd like to see. Maybe it's about a different way of working. Maybe it's about a different sort of initiative. Maybe it's just getting family members to do something a little different. And I'll ask you all just to take a second to jot down that goal, one of your goals. And we're going to come back to this a little later in the session. Great. Hopefully we have some big, ambitious goals being written down.
Or tiny, small goals.
Yeah. As Liza said, small wins are very important. What I'd like to do now is turn to hear from our first panelist, from Fred, to talk a little bit about the shift that he wanted to see in in his foundation, and the process that they went to realize it.
Good morning, everybody, and thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it, Jim, Liza. I think Liza just did a great job sort of laying out a framework that almost any decision making or moving, unsticking your foundation can fit into this framework. And I'm going to tell a story about a specific example of where we unstuck our foundation. And you'll see, I think, quite clearly that not only does it drop neatly into Liza's presentation already, but also, unbeknownst to me, because until yesterday, how great was that plenary session about systems thinking? Up until yesterday, I hadn't really heard of systems thinking except sort of in just this sort of abstract concept. But to see it in place, and then as I thought more about this process that the Daniels Foundation went through to unstick on this particular issue, we were doing some systems thinking without knowing that we were doing some system thinking. So to me, that's good because it means that system thinking can be instinctive, and I really encourage people to trust their instincts. So the Daniels Foundation was started by three brothers in 1949. My grandfather was the first president of the Daniels Foundation, and then my father succeeded him, and then my dad passed in 2002. We are, by the Articles of Incorporation, constrained to substantially, and that's a word that I live and die by, substantially contribute to the Worcester, the greater Worcester area. You can define substantially, and I will define it as well. But so we are constrained by that geographical opportunity there. But like many family foundations, for the first two generations, it was intrinsically patriarchal. That is to say, my grandfather and my father, they knew who they wanted to give to, they gave to who they wanted to give to, and the family members were there to say, all right, go dad, give to that person. When I took over the Daniels Foundation, I decided two things. First of all, that it was no longer relevant to be so entirely patriarchal. And secondly, that the other two members of the family, the other two family lines, were not well represented at all in the Daniels Foundation. And so I embarked upon a process of broadening the membership of the board and making equal the representation for each of the three family lines. So now there are four opportunities. Right now we're one shy, but four opportunities in each of the three lines, and we have a board of 12. So having put that in place, that was not without controversy, but we just began to give, and it became clear to me from the vantage point of being the president of the board that there was not much satisfaction being felt by the board members in the giving. That it was just like dad and granddad had been giving. That we were doing things the exact same way, and it just was not particularly fulfilling to them, especially some of these new people that we brought from these more distant family lines onto the board. And so the goal became to develop satisfaction. A good goal, satisfaction in giving. People should feel good about the giving that they do. And so the real question became, you know, what are we really talking about? How can we do that? Is it about the size of the gift? Should we give fewer gifts, more money? You know, these are the kinds of things that typically are discussed in a process like this. But we spent quite a bit of time talking about this, and all the while in the background, I was doing what I'm going to characterize as blowing it up. I knew who the people were who were more dissatisfied than others, and I was on the phone to them saying, well, what do you think? And I was empowering them to, and this is the collaborative element you talk about, empowering them to be more vocal, even as they were relatively new to the foundation, to be more vocal about why this was not satisfying, how they saw the giving model. And I let that sit for a while and gestate for a while and just really sort of simmer, and eventually got to the point where people said, we have to make a change. And as a leader, my sense was, now's the time to have the conversation, and it hadn't been quite ready to be had prior to that. Now's the time to make the conversation about change. So the real questioning began, well, what do we mean by satisfaction in giving? You know, do we want to do something? You know, what difference? What different things do we want to do? How do we want it to be different? We struck upon the notion that perhaps we should get more involved, get our hands dirty, be less of a checkbook foundation, and really come to know and understand something. But we didn't know what, but something. So we started asking a lot of questions. Who are we giving to? Why are we giving to them?
What does it mean that we give to them? Do they want us to keep giving to them in the same way that we're giving to them now? Is there a better way to be giving to them? All of these kinds of things made us arrive to the following goal, which is that what we wanted to do to be more satisfied in our giving was to make a difference, to go deeper, to give differently, and get our hands dirty. So we had those four elements of our opportunity in front of us. And so we said, well, fine. So how do we translate that or implement that or overlay that onto what we're obligated to do as a foundation? And so we just kept asking more and more questions until we had a sense that we got to the right question. And so in this particular instance, and I think oftentimes in life, the question sometimes is, how do you know you finally have arrived at the right question? And to me, the right question is the question that you don't know the answer to. That's the right question in a model like this. Because if in this particular case, if we knew the answer to it, it probably was a reflection of the consistent giving we've been doing since 1949. We know the answer to that question, so it's probably going to be kind of similar to what we've been doing. And we're trying to not do what we've been doing. So when we arrived at a question we didn't know the answer to, we knew we were at least on the right track. That was to develop a strategic focus and give more in a hands-on, interactive way over a longer period of time, as opposed to these grants that we were giving, where if you pretty much had a pen and a piece of paper, you could get some money from the Daniels Foundation. So when we knew we couldn't answer the question, we really also knew that we needed to turn to outside counsel, because if we can't answer it, we need to have people from the outside who can at least lead us in the direction of answering the question. And so we built a collaboration with the folks at United Way and some of the sort of broader-based community foundation of Greater Worcester, broader-based folks who could give us some information about that. We began to focus in on the fact that we wanted, in the context of making a difference, keeping those goals in mind, that we wanted to fund into an area where there was no funding. And only the people who are receiving funding would have a good sense of where there is no funding. And ultimately, we settled on girls age 10 to 14, receiving very little funding, nationally still is the case, but certainly in the Worcester area. And so we just kept asking questions again and again and again, and settled on this concept. Our project is called Investing in Girls. So we did what we knew we should do or could do. We developed a 3-year grant, we put out RFPs, we figured out how much money we were gonna give, $225,000 over 3 years, and we began to fund worthy projects. And we took some projects in, and they were great, and people felt good about it. And after about 2 or 3 years of this, we realized, and this goes to Liza's suggestion that you can be at different parts of her plan there at different times, we realized that actually what was happening is we were getting the same grants, just with a zero added to it and a little more commitment from the donor, but it was just as unsatisfactory as when we were giving smaller grants to more people, because we had framed it up in the exact same way. And so people, at first the excitement was there, then the blush wore off the rose, and then we were feeling like, well, now we're just, you know, giving more money. And more money is not better money, it's not better process. So we had to blow it up again. I took the initiative to blow it up again. And we asked ourselves, and this is the systems thinking piece that comes into the equation, if our grantees are responding in the exact same way as they were when it was one less zero, and then it must be something, or it could be something, that we're doing that we need to examine to do differently, as opposed to having an expectation that they would be responding differently just because there was another zero on the number. So that was the exploration that was ultimately fruitful. And it moved us into a zone where we began to realize that collaboration between girls serving agencies was going to have to be a critical piece of the equation, and that other elements of how we went about funding would have to also be a critical piece of it. And there were controversial elements associated with that. We began to fund backroom operations so that people would share, for instance, data platforms, because if they shared a data platform, not only could we get better information, potentially they could get better information as well. We funded independent research at the local universities about the girls in the community so that we understood better what was going on. Fast forward through this process today, we have a collaboration of anywhere between 10 and 12 girl-serving agencies in Worcester. We are funding 25% of our giving budget, which is about $1 million annually, so $250,000 is going towards the projects that are specifically done in collaborative model across these organizations. But we committed, controversially at first, but obviously now, an extra 10% of our giving budget to things like advocacy. What does it take to get into the schools? And we've successfully got into the public schools on girls' issues, all but the sex issue. They won't let us in on that. So backroom operations, shared platforms, collaborative models, conferencing that we pay for where they can get together, consultants that serve the collaborative interaction between the agencies. All the while, our projects are getting better because everybody understands the shared vision and goal. Our projects now coming to us looking for funding are multi-agency, and so they share the resources, and we now are also in a better position to say things like, if we get a project, a couple times we've said, you know, you've sent us a project, we'd like you to resubmit it after you talk to this other girl agency because you need transportation on this project, this other girl agency is long on transportation, and if we can get that to work together, then the money can go deeper to the real issues, the real needs. And so this created a sea change in our foundation around which people are more satisfied, they're going deeper, now their hands are dirty, we're doing site visits. All of these other benefits evolved out of this singular process. And so now the other 70%, 65 to 70% of what we do is more meaningful and our processes are more credible and they have more relevancy internally and externally. And so we are feeling much better about all of this. The key takeaway from my little story is this notion of risk, that a leader should not be hesitant to blow things up. That sometimes, you know, to make an omelet, you heard that old phrase, you know, you gotta crack some eggs, you know? And so the real bottom line and the beauty of working in a foundation is really a lot different, as you know, from working your regular day job. That failure is not the end of the line, unlike your regular day job. If you have a lot of failure consistently, you're not gonna be working there very much. Failure at the foundation level is something to be embraced, and that risk that's intrinsic and from which failure sometimes occurs is something that can be very useful as an impetus to move forward. I took advantage of the fact that my board members were scared of failure when I wasn't. I used it as a lever to get them to come together around certain topics. So, you know, you break some eggs and you make the omelet, but the bottom line is that if the omelet's no good, you still have scrambled eggs and they taste exactly the same. They just look a little more messy. So that's the takeaway on it. And there is a process to engage. And so I would encourage you to take those risks and to look for the lever points where as a leader in your foundation, you can begin to see the opening to institute change.
Thank you, Fred. That was great. Yeah, I mean, you make that sound really easy, by the way.
Yeah. It only
took 4 years.
Right.
Yeah.
That's very good.
It sounds to a certain extent that all your trustees were kind of in agreement and kind of moved along smoothly. I know it's your board members, it's a fairly diverse group.
Right. So it did not happen like that, right?
From different parts of the country, even different political backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did those differences, what sort of resistance did that cause? How did those differences create obstacles to moving that change forward?
Well, you know, for instance, the one area about funding backroom operations, you know, the real issue was, well, if we're giving that money there, then that's less money that's on the street, that's less money going, you know, for food going into a belly or for, a young girl to benefit in some other way. And that required having a lot of conversation about taking the longer view, which required that I constantly seek recommitment from the board members that this strategic grant, this strategic focus is something that we're looking at for the long term. And so always looking for examples of where, because we've been at it now for a while, long term, here's, look at this progress we just made. Look at this piece of data that just came back to us. We influenced that. We made that happen. And so, you know, I'm really happy to say that in the end of March, there's going to be a statewide gathering of agencies serving girls in the state of Massachusetts. And we have a major seat at the table. And hopefully we can, you know, make some inroads there.
Yeah.
How did the agencies take to you sort of pushing them, challenging them? Because, you know, I've ran into some that you ask an agency to do something or an nonprofit or something before they're ready, it, you know, you're setting them up to fail. So how did you kind of gauge what to ask, how much to ask, and who to ask?
Right, the critical thing is to ask them what they need to get that done. And so invariably, in our particular case, what they needed was to know each other better, but also to have some financial incentives, which we immediately ruled out additional granting. That is not the financial incentive we're talking about. But the financial incentive was the cost savings they could save and the time savings they could save, for instance, in this shared data platform. Because that allowed them to not only share information among agencies, and that was a little tricky, we had to work that out a little bit too, but it allowed them to more easily submit reporting to the state, and they could see the benefit if they understood better what their sister agency was doing. They could see the benefit of how that might affect their, allowed them to reduce duplication of services, and all of those kinds of things because they were saving data. So that was the incentive in the end, which worked most successfully.
Great, and there was...
Right. In this particular case, it was accounting functions that, especially with a number of our agencies, you know, it was great with the YWCA and Girls Incorporated and all that, but a number of our agencies are small. They could barely afford a part-time person to do their books, much less be able to afford the quality of a person to do the books. So we provided some funding to allow one qualified bookkeeper to work across four different agencies, backroom operations. And that brought them to the table and kept them at the table.
That's good.
Yeah. I'm Kathy Rogers, very inspiring, and you're way ahead of me. I would like to dial way back to the beginning to how, at the generational change, how you sorted out sort of the branch inequalities and how you encouraged passive members of the family to come where you talked about individual conversations. Was that your main method for getting people active? And in terms of the branch, are the family branches fairly equal in number, or if there was an inequality in numbers in the branch, how did you work out equal branch representation?
Right, good question. So the family branches are relatively equal. And the, being sort of the new, I've been on the board for, I don't know, 15 years before I was the newly minted president, and sort of the magical process of being anointed, my dad passed away very unexpectedly, being anointed there was sort of mystical to most, and I had to kind of prove myself in that regard. And ultimately, a lot of it was that individual one-on-one networking that you made a reference, but the decision about expanding the board and going to equal representation, which we were able happily to do by attrition largely and inviting other people on, that ultimately came down to Robert's Rules of Order and a vote. It was a flat out vote, and I exerted my influence and worked the back phones and called for a vote, and it was not an equal vote. And it's been revisited for Neil's early days. It was revisited a couple times. Every time it was like, let's have a vote.
So the family voted on who would be the board. Did the whole family vote on the whole thing, or did the branches vote on the branches?
No, everybody who was a current board member voted on expanding to these other branches and getting, you know, having a policy of equal representation in the branches.
But then to choose the four people from each branch, how was that done?
Oh, we left that up to the individual branch. Mm-hmm. So there was representation of each of the three branches unequal on the board.
Okay.
And so we said, well, your family, your branch, you figure out who comes on the board.
Great. Do we have one more question before we jump in here from Deborah?
I'm curious, was part of this
re-engineering of the board, the fact that leadership could rotate among any of the branches then, as opposed to always being in your branch?
Right.
Not yet been addressed.
Hasn't yet been addressed. And, you know, it's interesting because I've done a lot of searching in the old files. The rumor is that my grandfather was the one who put much more money in than the other brothers. I have no evidence to support that. But that's always was the mythology about why it would remain in my line. I think that I'm going to let that go. Ultimately, when my time as the president is done, I think it needs to be representative. There were these three brothers who started it. It's really not about how much money one put in versus the other back in 1949. Now it's about who's the best leader to move the foundation forward. It should not be hinging on one family line.
I'm curious if any of you then, somewhat related to that, have any thoughts on how to deal with the board where the five branches want to maintain permanent equality. There are no officers, there are no, it's just always the five will always be equal in everything.
And there's nobody in charge?
There's nobody in charge.
It's a hard way to do it. How many people are there then who make decisions together?
At the moment, five and about to become 10. Mm-hmm.
So there is an uneven number on the vote until it goes to 10.
No. Yes. Although nothing really happens unless it's unanimous.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a hard challenge.
It does sound hard. Do you have any, is there an outside person helping you to facilitate?
Yes, sometimes.
Okay, so that would be probably helpful.
Sometimes you got to have the vote. Maybe the issue is to visit the governance question about why it has to be unanimous.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't say that anywhere. It's just
then that sounds like a bylaws discussion. I'm trying to get that instituted.
Great. Hopefully we can dive into that question a little bit more when we do in the small table discussions. So what I'd love to do, thank you, Fred. Really appreciate that. Deborah.
That was so interesting. I feel like I want to just jump in and talk about all the same things that you were talking about because we have some very similar process.
See, you
going
wanted
on.
To go first.
I know. I wanted to go second, and I'm glad. No, but so
talking about all your things.
That's right. No, so I'm going to let you talk about that, and I'm going to talk about a different thing. We are a relatively new foundation. We're only in our 10th or 11th year of existence, and when I was asked to be part of this discussion, I thought, well, we haven't actually faced that many obstacles yet. We're still really in the golden age of the beginning. So I thought I would talk about the beginning, which in and of itself was a big step. You know, we went from just people to, and none of us with particular experience in anything related to this. The money came from my grandfather. He died with giving us no directive at all, other than he wanted us to give within this country and to make it a family effort. And besides that, he said, just go work it out. And he had three sons, like in your family. So he basically said, the three of you figure out what you want to do, but he didn't say who had to be the board member or how we would, nothing. So he died, and we said, okay, we have to figure out how to do this. And I think one of the things that worked in our favor was a pretty good sense of humility. We didn't think we knew how to do it. We knew we didn't know how to do it. And so we asked for help right from the beginning. And this is a little inadvertent plug for TPI, but we asked for help. We said, we need a consultant to guide us through this. We want to do a good job. And so we had two goals. We wanted to make an impact, and we wanted to work collaboratively and function well as a family. And we didn't want to sacrifice either thing for the other. And these can be two goals that really can be in conflict. You know, we could be all about being nice and not make any difference, or we could all be about strategic giving and have a lot of enemies. And we really weren't willing to let either of those things be in second place. So before we made a single grant, we locked ourselves away in a hotel room for a bunch of hours. At the first meeting was seven of us. That was my father, my two uncles, their spouses, and myself. I was asked along because my father had said he wasn't going to really take his role and he wanted me to have it from the get-go. And we spent many hours with a consultant from TPI trying to figure out where did our philosophies of giving, our ideas of change, where did they overlap? And it was many hours and many big sheets of paper like that. And we finally settled down into these three areas, which Jim had mentioned before: environmental justice, early childhood education, and families in crisis. And this pretty much reflected the professional lives of the three main ones of us. So that was kind of the first step. You know, how do we get started in a good way? One of the challenges, I think, for us have been, you know, those are not the only things we care about. And what we've found has been a real tool towards being able to stay with this pretty clear focus is we also decided, I think from the very first year, that we would each get a good chunk. We each get 10% of the overall giving amount. The three branches each get 10% for discretionary grants. And this, I'd say, if there was one tool that I would really highly recommend, that has allowed us, I feel like those discretionary grants has allowed us, has been the outlet for, because it's almost like this balance between, you know, all of the ego that goes with money and wanting to be in charge, and then the necessary humility that is needed to collaborate and to think about the value to the agencies. And I feel like the discretionary grants has been what made it work. Because then we could say, well, that's my special little thing, and I don't want to explain it to anyone. I just want to give it, and don't give me a hard time about it. And I'd say that's been the tool that has been most valuable to us. And if there was one, you know, thing I would say talk about doing to solve the disagreements and allow you to stay focused, that has been super helpful. Some challenges that we've had, of course, over the last couple of years is the range of amounts we've been able to give. In 2008, our portfolio went way, way down, and we had to back away from a bunch of groups. At that point, we had already become quite focused on, and this is more related to what you were talking about, children whose parents are incarcerated. That, you know, after we chose our three strategic areas, more and more, and this just happened organically, we started to learn about this area, about this population, a very underfunded, very overlooked population. We said, that's where we want to make a difference. And so when we had less money to give, we started to say to our other grantees, we're going to have to focus, we're going to have to rein it in a little bit, we're going to give to these groups. And because we had a clarity already, we were able to do that without fighting too much about who we were going to say goodbye to. Then in other years, like this year, we've been really lucky. We have a lot extra. And so we give some of the grants that you were discussing. Also, we do a lot of, not a lot, but a certain percentage of capacity building grants and helping with board development or IT things or summits, you know, get conventions, getting people, getting groups together to talk about issues that are related between their agencies. We're also now about to look towards the next generation. I'm the bridge person. So my uncles are in their 70s. I'm in my 40s. I'm the oldest of my generation. So I have cousins ranging in age from 20 to 40. And we're now trying to figure out how to get them in. And it is definitely going to be harder. I know that this has been the easy part. And now we're going to the harder part. And it's going to be my job to try to bridge this gap. The way we've started so far, and it's been with mixed success, is we've already given each, we're also basically three branches, and we've given each branch of this generation a relatively small amount of money to work with to just kind of get their feet wet and say, what does it feel like to give? How do you find organizations? And it's been with mixed results. You know, some of my cousins have been fantastic and really, you know, do the reading and do the site visits, and others just write a check to the same place every year. And I'll be facing a lot of the same challenges as we say, well, I don't want this just to be give to your local corner good guy. That's not what we're here to do. We are very big on site visits. We visit every one of our agencies every year. So we spend a lot of time, and we made about 40 grants a year. So it's a lot of visits. And they're mostly in the Northeast, but not entirely. So we spend quite a bit of time visiting. That is how we also got our board down to just three people, was we couldn't get that many people to do that many visits. I'm assuming foundations with big boards, do they all do the site visits? There's a question. You couldn't, right? You can't take 10, 20, 30 people. So that's one way, yeah.
In the past, our foundation has invited all foundation members, you know, all board members who are available to take the trip.
Yeah.
In some cases, everybody except one person went. In some cases, one or two people have gone. We also do board retreats mm-hmm. next to some of our grantees.
Yeah.
So we make it part of our annual board retreat
yeah.
to do the site visit.
Yeah.
Answer two, Daniels Foundation goes to, has its quarterly meeting at a different site. So we see four sites a year. And also grants at $25,000, grant requests at $25,000 and up, have to have a site visit from at least two board members in order to proceed. And that's a statement we make to the grantee and also to the board, and we say, get it together. And figure out how to make that happen. So the grantee is motivated. They know who to reach. Touch to get to come and do the site visit.
Because I would say I do think that site visits and our, you know, that's necessary. We organize our calendars. And it's only three of us, but we go to virtually every single one all together. And I'd say that has really addressed the need to get our hands dirty, to understand what are the real issues of the organizations that we're providing funding to. We do help them make connections with other organizations because we actually know them. And it's helped us to keep clear on why we're there. It's made us be pretty direct. Yeah.
Are your trustees and family members and grantees all within the same geographic area?
No. I mean, roughly, yes. We're mostly in New York, Massachusetts, and Vermont, and a little bit in California, and a little bit in Atlanta, and a little. But mostly, we're in that area. But it's still, I mean, it's a lot of planes and overnights, and we all have other jobs and families and stuff. So it's been a pretty major time commitment, which is what let us our board get very small, because the other folks couldn't really commit to that much. Yeah.
I have another question. So you talked about having three pillars initially, and sort of.
Right.
About how long was that process to sort of happen organically? How many years did you have three pillars before you realized that this is one overlapping?
I'd say about 4 or 5 years that we stayed with the three, and we tried to be very kind of fair between the three and give a third to each. And then we kind of happened upon this issue of kids with incarcerated parents, and we all said, that's what we want to do. And so basically, as soon as it seemed appropriate to pull away from another grantee who was doing better or went out of business, one or the other, we could pull away from them and say, okay, now we're going to give more towards this. But I'd say it took about 4 or 5 years, and we're still doing it. We still give in those non-focus specific areas, but every year the balance shifts more. Go ahead.
So this could be for both Jim and Deborah. You talked about now working with the next generation, how different people have different ideas of what philanthropy means, and how you have a certain vision that you hope to bring everybody on board with. And I know you used TPI initially. Do you envision it as somewhere where you might use education? And Jeff, maybe you can address how I ran across that as well. And
yeah, you've gone through more generations.
Process, did you do the education yourself, or did you find you needed to bring someone in?
We've used TPI, but not on the strategic grant issue that I described. But we turned to our friends, again, because we've been at this a long time.
Right.
We turned to our friends in the Worcester community, and they provided us with some educational background to help us make an informed decision about the direction to go in, and then also about how to get that done.
And I don't know yet how we're going to do it. I think I'm just starting to see what's going to be hard about it. So I'm not sure.
It sounds like you, Deborah, also have, you're already in a position where you have some authority and leadership as a program officer in the organization, and then you said you were anointed president. And I guess my question is, how do you be a leader and, you know, organize and catalyze some change when you're not the appointed, you know, executive director, president, or something, but you see other change that needs to happen?
So how would you go about it? Well, I think, I mean, it sounds like for both of us, we are kind of in a stated position of authority, so it's already there. If we weren't, well, for me, I would come back to the, if you do the work, you get the authority. You know, I think if anyone wanted to really dig in and do it, you know, go to the visits, make the meetings, do the thinking, do the talking, then you have something that you know, and you can say, well, I know this. I'm not just coming because I want to be bossy. I'm telling you this because it's based on something I have learned from my work. So I feel like, to me, that's the only way you can get credibility is by really getting your hands dirty.
Yeah, I think that's the key word, the credibility word, because when I was anointed, I know that rubbed some people the wrong way. Yet, the very first thing I tackled was the notion of broadening the representation of the families to the board. that was a little counterintuitive. And so I often call for votes. I use Robert's Rules of Order. I think it's an important tool for a leader to be comfortable with. If you're not familiar with Robert's Rules, I would urge you to get familiar with Robert's Rules. Hey, look, the vote's the vote. Majority wins. If I have a vision and it's constantly voted down, then in my opinion, it's time for me to step aside. Mm-hmm. Somebody else needs to take charge.
And just to echo something Fred said earlier when he was talking about he's the leader up here, but he started his change by talking to everybody else down here and bringing it up from the bottom. So sort of creating that urgency. So he started having conversation with people who aren't in the position of authority, and then they came to the group and said, listen, we need to change our focus, or whatever the change he was talking about, that example. But it does start from the masses and from down here and using your voice and getting other people on your team.
I know Ellen Remmer, managing partner at TPI, loves what she calls practice. Like just little practice exercises. They don't have to be big, they can be really small, but it's just that just process of trying to do something a little different in a really small way that allows you to be more comfortable to try to tackle that in a little bigger way, then a little bigger way, then a little bigger way. And so when you don't have that on paper authority, you're going to have a much easier time trying something small and something modest to help you build up that credibility. Mm-hmm. Other thoughts or questions for Deborah?
Or Fred?
What I'd like to do now is just we're going to do two more questions on your worksheet, and then we're going to do a little small group discussion. What I want to do is just take a minute to think about and reflect on a moment when you ideally have played a leadership role within your foundation, or if you haven't, you don't feel there, think about somebody else who's played that kind of leadership role within the foundation. And just one example, and think about what obstacles they were against, and what do you think made it successful, assuming it was successful? And if it wasn't, what do you think was the thing that really made it unsuccessful? And so just take just a minute to jot down a couple thoughts there.
And we are eventually going to have some table discussion. So if you are at a table by yourself or your table looks particularly thin, you might want to think about moving around a little to people have some conversation.
Great. Thank you all. How these conversations go? Would love. Yes, we're going to ask to just kind of wrap up these conversations now. Would love to do just two last things we need to do before we send you off into the greater conference world. I know. Yeah. All right, guys, two last things I'd like to do before we get going. The first is I would just love to kind of go through the tables and if somebody wants to share any of the approaches that they kind of walked away with, something interesting they heard that they might want to try, or something interesting they heard that they know they're absolutely not going to try. We'll start back there. Any kind of thoughts? We talked about a couple interesting things you guys were doing. This middle table?
More of what Fred was recommending, more background, kind of getting support before blowing things up and facilitating change or declaring war or something like that.
Great. And this front table here, any great thoughts, examples, approaches you're walking away with?
I
great. Absolutely. Yeah, I think, I mean, I heard some great things from the conversations before, just being getting people to be more vocal, like Fred was talking about, getting people to talk and figure out what's really behind what they want to do, what they're doing. It allows them to kind of process their thinking. It also allows them to be heard. Not being heard can be a significant obstacle to change. The idea of taking risks, I mean, there's few other spheres outside of philanthropy where you can take so much risk and be okay. So that idea of just having the courage to blow things up. Humility, Deborah, as you mentioned, you know, just go in it humble. Go when you don't know the answers. Look for help. Ask others. Turn to the community, as Fred's foundation did, to bring in others into that conversation. And then find those tools that you can use, the things like the internships, the things like discretionary grants, things where you can kind of create some of those immediate wins. So you can landing a couple planes as you're really trying to figure out what the you know, air traffic control should look like. So these are all some great things. What I would love you guys to do now is just take one more minute to write down your next steps. You're going to walk out of here, wow, a lot of great ideas. Yeah, I can tackle the world. I can change my foundation. Then you're going to get back home, and you're going to start answering emails, and you're going to forget about everything that we talked about here. So right now, just take a minute to write down, what are you going to do when you get back home? What is that first step that you're going to take to try to catalyze that change that you want to see in your foundation? All right, everyone, I want to thank you for your time today. I want to thank you for sharing. I want to let you know that we're going to convene at next year's conference, and we're going to check everyone's next steps to make sure they are all done. I don't. And then the last just housekeeping bit is, if we could remind you guys all, Fred, Deborah, Liza, and I just work on tips, so if you could fill out your evaluations so we get great reviews and can make a lot of money off of this this session, that would be great. So please, whether you want to do it online on the evaluation on the app, or whether you want a hard copy, Andy has one. Thank you for remembering that. Great. Thank you all for joining. Enjoy the conversation.